It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly, and I'm here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we are back to talk about a new show. It is a Netflix show called Stranger Things.
This one's gotten so much buzz, we couldn't help but turn on the TV and check it out. So you guys know we always like to know more about the showrunners of the show. So we found a little bit about the Duffer Brothers. So it turns out that they're twin brothers, and they were actually born in 1984. I found this so crazy because so much of what they do seems to be nostalgia of the 80s. So kind of crazy that they really didn't grow up in the 80s. They really grew up in the 90s.
The date on the show is 1983, a year before they were born. But they're so slavishly dedicated to getting the fashion right and the decorations around the house right and just the whole atmosphere right. I was born in the 70s. And I tell you what, I have no love affair whatsoever with anything from the 70s except for Star Wars.
I completely agree. I felt like they did a really great job really trying to capture everything from the 80s right from the beginning. I saw so many parallels.
Did you find out anything else about the Duffer Brothers?
From the Twitter sphere, Stephen King actually tweeted them and said, "Watching Stranger Things is like watching Stephen King's greatest hits. I mean that in a good way." That kind of cracked me up. He's right. And you know what? Stephen King, to me, was in his heyday in the 80s. He had so many different things going on, TV and movies and books, and everything was coming out. And I agree. I think there's so many things that are similar to his work as well, which means it's awesome.
They molded their various pitch materials, like posters and treatments and book covers and all that kind of stuff, to look like Stephen King book covers. They even admitted to using one of the variations of the Firestarter book cover to be the image with the abandoned bicycle and then the words Stranger Things above it in a very 80s horror novel style font.
We're going to jump right in with episode one, The Vanishing of Will Byers. Automatically, I'm a scare baby, so I'm already kind of on edge.
You should know this about Caroline. She doesn't particularly care for depictions of violence against children as being called entertainment.
I know, I'm so weird like that. I'm so weird.
So it took a little doing to get her interested in this show.
It really did. The idea that a kiddo would be in any way kidnapped, vanished, taken, whatever, right from the start made me queasy. For all of you guys who don't know, Paul and I have three special needs kiddos, and protecting them and making sure that nothing like this ever happens is my number one job. I was just completely taken aback. But let's start from the beginning. So the setting is Hawkins, Indiana, in November 6th, 1983.
Yeah, I think this is supposed to be just a plain old anywhere place and a plain old anywhere time.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on any old time. I mean, we're definitely, most definitely going to love on the 80s here.
Well, there's a love affair with the 80s, but I think what you gain with the 80s, actually, now that I think about it, is you lose cell phones and the information age being at your fingertips. I haven't watched the whole series yet, so I don't know if they get in any predicaments where that kind of thing would save their bacon, but I'm betting so.
And it's really kind of one of the last periods of time where we're sort of getting to that part where kids don't stay out by themselves riding their bicycles. I mean, in fact, like these days, remember those parents got called up by like CPS for letting their kids go to the park by themselves and playing, even though they were like, one was like 11 or something. So we live in a completely different world now. So I think we have to go back to this time where things were just quieter and
so kids could run without too much fear. And
it was okay within your small town. That was okay. And this is exactly what I did. I grew up for a short time in Massachusetts, and I wonder all the time, what must my mother have thought? Because we took off in the morning and we were gone until dinner, and she didn't know where we were. You know, we were right. Running all over, and we had woods behind our house and a brook and friends and stuff. We would run around. There was a cemetery up there. I mean, there was plenty of stuff to get into trouble. Now, we were perfectly good kids. We were building tree forts and stuff like that.
All honorable child
behavior. No vandalism or anything. But for sure, in 83, we would have only been 6 years old. So we're not exactly contemporaries to these kids, but close enough. So many of the things that they experienced, their interactions with their parents and siblings and everything, was very relatable.
We'll definitely comment each and every time something like that happens to be very familiar for us. The show starts at the ominous looking spooky U.S. Department of Energy laboratory in Hawkins. A scientist is running through the hallways, complete with flashing, like, is the electricity failing or is there an emergency style lights flickering? And he's frantically trying to get out of his current situation.
There's like super desperation in the air. He's panting and sweating and running, and he's getting to the elevator, and it's that horrible feeling of like, push the button, push the button, push the button, and it's just not moving fast enough.
Definitely not. Finally gets into the slowly moving elevator.
Painful lift.
Only to be sucked up into the ceiling by something we don't know what.
And this exact scene, the running, the, I want to say that like panicky feeling, that like kind of like running kind of feeling, I was transported exactly back to Ghostbusters with the elderly librarian running amongst the book stacks, and the music is like pulsating, 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 and then there's like the ghost like pops out and it's like, you know, it's like, it like goes right in, you know, and it's just like, oh, wow. OK, so you've got all of my memories right back into the 80s. Instantly, you got me there.
You might even go to the opening of The Stand. Did you ever watch The Stand?
I didn't.
It opens up with an emergency at a secret government facility where people are trying to get out like crazy. It's not a monster, but it's the same kind of idea where people are trying to get out of these lockdown areas.
Well, and I'm not as much of a sci-fi girl. If you guys are just joining us, I'm sort of the less nerdy half of the two of us. Paul brings in all of
I cast a long shadow in that department.
All of his sci-fi knowledge. And so I'm going to bring in some other information. But from what I understand, Aliens is also like sort of hearkened in this sort of these types of buildings. And
well, it's
these
got
kind
the claustrophobic,
and, yeah. Like, stainless steely walls and...
Yeah,
always.
Yeah, the same. Both Alien and Aliens have that closed in, like, I need to get out of here kind of feeling, and not knowing from what direction the monster is going to come from. That also fits right into this era of filmmaking.
We cut away to a sprinkler and a very common looking suburban household with some boys playing a little Dungeons and Dragons down in the basement.
Now, my nerd hat would say, I don't know that this is Dungeons and Dragons.
That's awesome, because as soon as I see people sitting around and reading out of a book, I'm like, they're playing Dungeons and Dragons. Because my office is filled with role-playing games, because look at me, I know they're called role-playing games. I'm proud of myself. That they could be playing a myriad of games here. It's got to be D&D, though. Come on.
It definitely evokes the scenes where we meet Elliot and his family in E.T., because that is what they are doing.
Is that what they're doing?
The older boys are playing Dungeons and Dragons. They've got a whole map set up. They've got their guys that they're moving around. And Elliot isn't really in on the game. He's there to watch out for the pizza man and stuff like that.
That's right. He's definitely the little brother in that.
Yeah, but it's still the same sort of atmosphere where the guys are playing D&D. There's a lot of tension being built up because the dungeon master, who we don't know any of their names yet, but we find out his name is Mike, is building up the tension of whether or not this certain monster is going to come. And the next boy's move is the boy we know as Will. We will know that he is Will by the end of the show.
I totally gave them nicknames right at the beginning. So Mike I named Cheekbones. Because come on, that face. And then Dustin, I nicknamed Gummy, because come on. And then Lucas is our wise Kraken. He's always got like the voice of reason / quick witty comeback. And Will just seemed like your all-round good boy next door kind of kid. Like everyone would want to have this kid playing next door.
At issue is Will's decision. Will he take the safer road, cast some sort of healing or safety or protection spell, which is apparently his normal thing, or will he take the offensive and use his fireballs against the monster?
Because I'm not a role-playing gal and I don't know too much about this stuff, what I was gathering was that his spell would protect himself but I guess leave the rest of them vulnerable to whatever was coming. Or,
oh, well, you're out nerding me on this.
I mean, I don't know, but this is what I gathered. But if he actually went offensive, then maybe he could stop the monster and thereby protecting everybody. That's how I was taking it. And because all the boys were sort of disagreeing about what he should do, he seemed like a good kid. So they roll the dice and flies off the table. And of course, Mom. There's always a mom. So mom totally yells down, is all like, Mike, it's time to stop playing. And instantly I recognized this lady from Mad Men. I was like, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Look at her. Oh my God. It's Dr. Faye. What?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. It's the former flame of Don Draper.
She mommed out, yo.
Yeah,
she went from like single blonde working career woman in
who couldn't stand kids
in like the 60s, right?
Yeah,
late 60s that was at that point.
Yeah,
now she's at 83 and she's got that actually like aged kind of right. Her daughter, her kids are actually like she could have had kids right away. Now she's long haired, brown haired, you know, mom with the abdomen going on. She's got mom jeans.
Totally,
there's a lot of mom jeans in this, regardless of whether you're a mom or not. That's a lot of abdomen happening.
Oh yeah, they found some of the highest waisted jeans available.
And pleats. Lots of pleats over those abdomens. Because you don't want it to, you know, you want to like add volume.
All right, so mom breaks up the game, sends the boys home, and Will finds the dice that has flown off the table and admits to Mike the fireballs didn't work. I rolled too low.
He only rolled a 7. I guess he needed a 13. One of the things that I noted, because this mom sounded just like me, when Michael was like wanting to play longer and he's like, we didn't know it was going to take like, you know, however they played for like 10 hours or something. And she was like, what? Like, that's all you've been playing? I feel like I'm a role-playing game widow. And so like, I know when they start playing that stuff, it's like, you guys, it's Monday. You all have to go to work. Like,
that's how long it takes.
You have to leave now.
That's just how long it takes.
It's crazy, but I could see how the kids get totally sucked in. How did you feel about when Mike tries to appeal to dad and be like, dad, come on, like, you know, be on the boys' side here.
Well, as a dad, I don't think that this dad represents very well. But I was reminded immediately of Matthew Broderick's dad from War Games, who has about the same impact on screen time as this dad. He's just doing his own thing, not caring or noticing what anyone else is doing.
I felt like it did capture that idea of us being 11 years old. We've discussed like our fathers could not name our friends' names. They certainly didn't know what we were doing or what we were into. I feel like most families, when the kids are maybe around 11 or something, the parents are in their like later 30s or that type of age range where career is really hitting hard. And I feel like they were mostly at work. Like they would go to work, they'd be grouchy, come home, watch TV, eat dinner, go to bed. It's not like dad had all this crap to do per se.
It was a real golden age.
It was just, I feel like this is the time when dads had like 15 or 20 years in the workforce, and they were sort of kind of this combination of like worn down in their marriage. They have teenagers and babies and wives and bosses. And I just felt like that man, like there was like stink lines coming off of him of like, I hate my life. Listen to your mother. Like just nothing, just totally nothing.
The same shit, different day, coffee cup guy.
Oh my God. Isn't that in the like 80s when that cup came out? Like that's exactly what I mean. I don't know. There's this like working girl, everybody put your sneakers on, put your head down, get to work, get your briefcase kind of vibe feeling. Everybody need to be busy.
We also get to meet Nancy, Sister Nancy. She's on the phone upstairs.
Well, little Gummy, he's got a heart, man, right? So I think Gummy, he's Dustin. To me, his little face, he's such a little Monchichi. Like, he's so adorable. If you do not remember the Monchichis, please go Google them, because then do like a little side-by-side screenshot of Dustin's little face and a Monchichi. I had a little Monchichi stuffed animal. I should have named him Dustin, clearly. Obviously, they're at that age, that 11 age, where they're not really totally into girls. But at the same time, there's a little awkwardness like, oh, maybe I'll go give this pizza to Nancy.
He tries. And Nancy is uninterested.
Rebuffed. He gets totally the door slam in the face. All the boys are going to head out. They all need to leave. They completely have the ET headlight business on their bikes. That's all I could think of. And this is when Will admits that, hey, you know, the roll was only a 7. I didn't win. And the boys take off.
This is when the 80s style, particularly what I'll call John Carpenter style synthesizer music picks up. If you haven't watched any John Carpenter movies, or you don't know that you have, they are things like The Thing and Escape from New York and Big Trouble in Little China, The Prince of Darkness. They all have synthesizer scores that John Carpenter wrote himself. And the music that was written for this sounds like it was just cast off from one of those other movies. It just fits exactly right in with that genre and that style.
As soon as it came on, I was like, this sounds so familiar. Like, I can't place it, but it's familiar. Like, it's somewhere in my memory banks, this musical type. This little back and forth between Lucas and Dustin totally reminded me of the movie Big, when they're Josh and...
Tom Hanks.
He's Josh.
Oh, not Tom Hanks.
Right. Josh and not Tom Hanks are like razzing each other all the time. And so Lucas is like, good night, ladies. And he kind of like peels off. And Dustin's like, kiss your mom goodnight for me. As if they're like such players and everything. So funny.
Dustin and Will decide that they're going to race. Will says that if he wins, he would like to borrow Dustin's copy of the X-Men number 134. And I used my nerd powers to look it up, and that...
He's like, go-go nerd juice.
And the nerd wiki says, that particular issue of X-Men is when the Dark Phoenix is first introduced to the X-Men saga.
Now, when I think of the word Phoenix, I think of Stefano from Days of Our Lives, rising from the ashes, which would imply a fire. That's my frame of reference for the Phoenix. Stefano D'Amira.
No, I don't think that's going to be right.
You don't think Stefano's going to pop up?
No,
he'll be like, Marlena!
No.
Hey, there is a Will in Days of Our Lives, so maybe that's our crossover, Easter egg there.
I think we're getting off the track here.
All right, so tell me about this Phoenix introduced in your comic book.
All right, well, one of the original X-Men is a girl named Jean Grey. Jean Grey was known as Marvel Girl. She got like one of the worst names ever in the history of comics. Her powers included being kind of a lightweight psychic and a lightweight telekinetic, meaning that she could read your mind and move stuff with hers. Eventually, some mystical energy called the Phoenix Force invaded her body and kind of took over her personality and amped up her powers incredibly. This then led her to becoming the Dark Phoenix, which was someone even more powerful, still in Jean Grey's body, those same kinds of powers, but now she kind of had a chip on her shoulder. What the Dark Phoenix is basically known for is that she wiped out something akin to like a galaxy, a solar system, a universe, something to that effect.
Good
in,
Lord.
In retaliation for
something. Not our universe, though?
No, it was, you know, some...
It's another universe?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the point is, several billions of beings died in order for her to have her retaliation. So if the emergence of that character in that comic book is meant to
imply... Give a little foreshadowing.
Right. The remainder of the people we have to meet in this episode, it casts a pretty dark shadow.
We've only seen episode 1 and 2. So I am putting my money that there is going to be a big fire. I don't know. I have other things that I found during the episode, but I have that feeling of that. And so again, like the Phoenix, all this, I don't know, it just makes me feel that way. I felt like they did quite a bit to actually show a real big difference between, and we've only been in episode 1 and 2, so I can only tell you a little bit, but Mike, Lucas, and Dustin's life and where they live seem different than Will's life. For one thing that I noticed is at one point they call it East Hawkins. And so the fact that Will, of course, has to go like further outside of town. He doesn't live like right there in like suburbia proper. There's definitely an indicator that Will is in a different socioeconomic echelon there. And I think that they really go to great lengths to show the differences. So Will has to go through a restricted area to take a shortcut. Always a red flag for moms. Don't take a shortcut through the woods at night.
What is up with this restricted area that has chain link fence everywhere except the road?
I don't know. Bad perimeter fencing, guys. There's like a flash with his headlight on his bike, and there's definitely a thing in the road. And all I could get was that it had like, it was tall and skinny and like long hands.
Man-shaped, generally, like not insectoid or anything, but gangly and not where it belonged.
So this frightens Will, and he ditches his bike because he kind of comes down this embankment and he just takes off running.
And he eventually finds his way home. I guess that's what...
He lives in the woods.
Yeah, that's what gets back to what you were saying. Like, yeah. These other kids are definitely suburban kids, whereas Will is out of ways.
Yeah, he lives in the woods. Like, he runs past the clothesline, which his friends and everything, I mean, they had their washers and dryers and, you know...
Yeah.
They were definitely showing a distinction.
He runs inside and he is alone. Nobody is there with him. We haven't met the rest of his family yet, but none of them are there anyway.
He's like screaming. This was so scary. So scary. Can you imagine if something was chasing you and you burst into your house as a little kid and there was no mom or dad or anybody there? Like you have to fight the bad thing on your own. This is like every little guy's worst nightmare.
He looks outside and he sees the man thing coming toward the house.
I bet the thing is looming.
Tries to use the phone. No phone.
God, I forgot about rotary phones and how like awful they are, right? We were like, how come 911 is so hard to call? Like, why didn't they make it like 211? Like, you have to go like 911. Like, oh my God, with the rotary phone. It was like, come on.
But he runs out back to the shed where he finds and loads a bolt action rifle.
Which, hey, good on him, man. He is a much, much, much better prepared kid. That's what I mean about, like, he seems to have his head on his shoulders. I feel like Dustin would have peed his pants and hid under the bed. I'm not sure what Lucas would do. I kind of feel like Lucas would be, like, kind of a little more, like, badass in, like, try to come up with a more clever plan. Not necessarily more effective, but more clever. I felt like with Will, he's just so practical. Like, I was almost like an older man in a little guy body.
The gun doesn't do him any good, though, because somehow, inside the shed, the monster is standing right behind him without coming in the front door or very obviously having gotten into the shed before he did. So this is some kind of very sneaky guy.
Well, wait, too. What about like the fact that when Will was like looking at the door, the chain lock slid to the side on its own and came out and like the door hit open.
So you're thinking this monster can move stuff without touching it?
I'm saying that it has some different rules for its body and its abilities than human.
There's a moment when things get very scary for Will. And we're focused up on a light bulb at that time. Light bulb turns on and everybody is gone. No monster, no Will, no rifle. And the shed is empty.
No blood, no guts, no nothing. Just gone. Just gone without a trace. As a mom, again, I'm like looking at Paul. I'm like, I don't know how long I can watch this. I don't know how long I can watch this.
She did not enjoy that.
It's so scary for me. So, okay, what types of things were conjured up when you were seeing the shed and everything? All I could think of was E.T. and Elliot and
definitely
and all the clanking around and the monster in the shed kind of feeling.
Yeah, it was the same thing. Because if you recall from E.T., that's where he first kind of runs into E.T., who is, of course, a benevolent little herbivore creature.
Aw, he does enjoy his rhesus beasts.
That you would not need to shoot. I have to believe it was designed specifically to evoke that same kind of thing. Get up in the morning, the next day, more synthesizer music, and we are in a much different house. We are in a very messy house, and we see a man sleeping on a couch.
I honestly thought that this was Will's dad sleeping on the couch. That's what I thought. I thought he had come in and fallen asleep on the couch, maybe from work or whatever. And so I honestly thought that this was Will's dad at first, because it kind of seemed like we were in the same type of home. Yeah. At that moment in time. Like, it didn't seem like we went back to Mike's or anything like that. So, seemed like we were still there.
It definitely seems like a cabin more than the
house. Well, again, a woodsy home for sure, right? There's definitely this palpable heartbeat part to the music that is going, that really, I mean, I'm very sensitive to stuff like that when it comes to like sounds and images and things like that. And so when there's like a heartbeat kind of sound like that, then like my heart starts beating like at that rate. They were doing a good job of manipulating me through the imagery and the music. They did a very good job of manipulating how I was feeling.
Were you surprised when the very out of shape big guy who smokes through his getting ready routine turns out to be the local police chief?
I was super surprised. But in the background of him getting ready, I was listening to things that they were saying. This is when they brought up that in East Hawkins is where they were having all these surges and power outages, basically what we were seeing at Will's house. You know, the main thing that I thought about him was just, I still kind of thought he was Will's dad, honestly, at that moment, because he drinks, he does like, he brushes his teeth, he takes some pills out of a prescription bottle, he's like spraying deodorant and smoking at the same time, which, again, I think it really underlined, emphasized the difference between then and now, because our kids are 12 and 13 and 13, and they barely ever have seen anyone smoke. And it was only a couple of years ago when our son saw a man light up a cigarette in public and he was like, oh my God, your face is on fire. Because that is how unusual and odd it is. So for this guy to be like in his house, in his bathroom, smoking while he's putting on deodorant was like, wow, okay, reminder. It was a different world, completely different time.
We live in the suburbs, everyone. We don't live in the mountains or anything where we don't see other people. So come on now, our kids see people. And
right, I'm not trying to say we're hermits. I'm saying there's just not that many people that smoke.
That's true.
Anymore.
No.
Especially because it's so segregated. Like before you could be like walking through the mall and see someone smoking, but now you have to be outside so many feet away from the building or in your little corralled area, you know, like they do everything they can. The smoking pen, right? But in the background, this news report lady was saying, can you remember your favorite stuffed toy from childhood and how heartbroken you were when it left your life? All I could think was like, wow, this is like the Duffer Brothers.
You're trying to say it's like a love letter to the 80s. Like, don't you miss the way it was? So this is them putting it down on video. Yeah. How they feel about
the 80s. And I think too, like that idea, like it was instantly saying to you, hey, don't you remember those great movies like E.T., Ghostbusters? And don't you miss when they were gone? Well, guess what? Like, we're about to serve this shit right back up to you and you're going to love it. So they did a great job, I thought, again, of just sort of like just kind of peppering it in.
And they make great use of that modern technique of using things like TV and radio to fill in the expository details.
That felt actually very Leftovers, didn't it? Because they watched the news on the Leftovers all the time.
I mean, we've seen it to great effect in the Leftovers, but now that we know that it's a great trick.
Well, in Colony, they don't have TV, so it's not the same. Yeah, that's
true. But still, I mean, it's a great way of not having to have a character go through the trouble of saying, hey, did you hear about the power outage back in East Hawkins? You
know? Yeah, I like it. I think it's a great way to layer. So we see him pin on that police chief badge there and put on his Mountie's hat, and he's out. He's off to work to protect and serve.
Now that he's properly medicated and ready.
He's like lubed up with whatever he needed.
Go to Will's house and we get to see the show's only big star. After this person, everyone else is someone you've seen maybe here and there, but no one quite like Winona Ryder, who they have appropriately made look as haggard as humanly possible.
I think that she looks like how she feels, which is just like the weight of the world is on her shoulders. And I immediately wrote frazzled mom. The funny thing about that to me was that I kind of looked up some things afterwards to be like, you know, what were other people thinking about Winona in this role? And in every single review, not once did they miss calling her frazzled. The frazzled mom, frazzled mom, frazzled mom. I'm like, wow.
Well, everything from the tone of her voice to the fact that her hair is never done. And her outfits are always just...
We're kind of into hair at our house.
Well, the whole aesthetic thing is just really well done to making her look like she never has the time or at least the energy or interest to put much of that energy and interest into her own appearance.
I just don't think they have the money or the time. I don't think it's interest, but I just think she is just dog tired. The interaction that she has with Jonathan, who is Will's older brother, lets me know that they have had this sort of push and pull of who is the adult and who's the kid and who is actually running the household for a very long time. He's over there cooking breakfast and she's kind of going down her mom checklist, like, did you do this? Did you do that? You know, where did you get Will up? Did you do this? And he's like, I'm making breakfast, but you know, I didn't get him up yet. And she's like, well, I told you, you have to make sure he's up. Like, this is clearly an interaction they've had all the time. You know, like, this is the morning cuckoo-ness that happens of like, did you do this? Did you do that? I gotta go. I can't believe it. I left $5 under the thing, get a pizza. I gotta go.
He was not home when she expected him to be home the previous night. And he offers what sounds like a pretty flimsy excuse.
He says he was working, and he says he was working because he felt like they needed the money. And she says, like, working, as if he doesn't have a job. I don't know, right? Like, she wasn't like, oh, you picked up an extra shift at no. Whatever.
Well,
like, she was like, working.
And that he should have known better than to schedule to be working at the same time that she was working, 100%. Especially at night.
Yes. I am not convinced that he has a job. So what I'm saying, when she's like, question mark, it's kind of like working.
I mean,
like,
the rest of the interactions we have with Jonathan this episode suggest he's not fully an adult, not quite.
I couldn't quite, at least at this point, I definitely didn't understand really what age he was. I thought maybe he was still in high school, but I wasn't really sure. He was up and dressed and making breakfast in the morning, which, you know, implied that he wasn't like, you know, lays about kid all day or something. So
we missed it, but her name is Joyce.
Joyce
super calls
mom name.
Yes, Joyce calls Mike's house and gets Mike's mom a little nervous for just 1 second because she wants to know if Will spent the night. No, he did not.
Karen is Mike's mom. And this was a wicked mom move that she did because she's like, hey, you know, is that Will's voice I hear in the background? And Karen's like, no, what? Like, why are you even saying that? And he's like, she's like, oh, you know, I'm sure he just left early from class. That is like classic mom cover up. Like, I don't want to look like a jerk to this other mom. So I got to be like, oh, he probably is like making me a special Valentine in the other room. Like, right. You know, like you gotta like come up with something quick. And if you go back to Karen's house, all the kids were sitting around the table. They were all eating like this nutritious breakfast. Dad was there. Baby was there and everything. Meanwhile, at Will's house, they're like standing up, running around, whatever. Like, they're really doing a drastic job of showing the two households and how it's all very different for Will's house.
From Mike's house, the boys ride the bikes, get into school, and are immediately accosted by some very 80s style bullies who pick on them for being, well, Lucas is black, so he's different. Gummy has his whatever's going on with his teeth issue. And Mike just hangs out with them. So I guess that's his
They call him Doll
sin.
Face.
Oh, well.
Because he's got that porcelain skin and those really high cheekbones.
Now, these bullies are not any bigger than these other boys, but they, in attitude, remind me very much of every other 80s movie bully there ever was.
I feel like every kid bully, period. He is the same kid bully that is from A Christmas Story with, you know, just sort of the like...
Scott Farkas.
Scott Farkas is in his little...
Toady,
yeah. He totally was just one of those interactions where I mean, I don't get this. And I think it is a boy thing completely to have to go over and do the what's on your shirt? Oh, flicked you in the nose, like kick you in the shin. Like, I don't get it. I mean, girls do shitty things to each other, but this was like, oh, why are boys so weird?
Well, I think maybe, and maybe this will be totally wrong, but from a storytelling point of view, this was an excuse to show us that Toothless can pop his shoulder out.
Ah, I caught that he had to do that, but you're right. I feel like that could definitely come up to help later, huh?
In other movies, the person that gets tied up.
Yeah, I've seen this many times.
That
I've
can
seen
pop
it
their
underwater.
Shoulder out.
I've
can
seen
can
it.
Get out. Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, that was Houdini's trick, right?
Yeah,
he could pop
yeah.
his shoulder out and that could get him out of trouble.
That's right. Love it. So then we head to the high school where we see Nancy and her pal Barb. Barb, I could not even focus on her face or anything going on because the only thing I could see
was 18 inches of denim-covered abdomen.
Oh my God, I wrote holy abdomen Batman. Like, what the Barb's pants is going on? Like, wow, 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 wow. That was insane. So she is totally decked out with her ruffled shirt. And that I feel like the hair color that she is sporting is Molly Ringwald red, orange, whatever. It is like a specific color. And I guarantee you that that is like right on.
It's fair to say that. But I believe in Goonies, Martha Plimpton had similar hair.
No, maybe she's like blonder.
Okay, but the glasses.
Oh, heck
yeah. All Plimpton.
The glasses. Plimpton glasses, Ringwald hair all day long. And the like ruffly shirt, that is definitely also for certainty a Ringwald specialty.
They're going back and forth about Nancy's new love interest, Steve Harrington.
Oh my God. I forgot about like being in school and calling people by either their whole name, or I also love it when she's like, Tommy H and Carol will be there. The idea of referring to people with their last initial is, oh my God, that's so funny.
Nancy's trying to play it off. She's trying to be real cool in front of Barb that, you know, this is not a big deal, whatever. And then she finds a note inviting her to a bathroom makeout session immediately in her locker, which she elects to attend.
She's like, RSVP, one Nancy. Oh my gosh. So yeah, so she meets up with Steve in the bathroom and all I wrote was, ick, ick, ick. Steve is just,
She's unimpressed with Steve in every way.
Apollo, he is every douchebag that you never want your daughter to meet. He is the guy whose parents are always away, who always has access to alcohol with no questions asked. It's just there. He just has it. He always has some like bad idea brewing, you know? There's always something in his back pocket.
And his current idea is he would like to invite Nancy out to something, and she says, no, I got to study. And so he turns that into, well, then I'll just come over. And she would rather that not happen either, or so she says. But he still has...
She's playing hard to get, P. Come on.
She would still plan on... He still plans on coming over.
So, no, also, they were just going to chill in his car, which I think is the 1980s version of Netflix and chill. It's just the way you say it, a little different.
That's good decoding.
So here's the thing. Steve says, listen, meet up with me at Dearborn and Maple. She's like, no, it's a terrible idea. For some reason, I thought, you know what? When they give you like specific information like that, like your specific comic book issue number, you got to go look and see like what happened.
Well, what did you find?
Intersection. So there were three different instances that came up right away with fires that had to do with both Dearborn and Maple. There was a fire in Chicago at the intersection of Dearborn and Maple in the electrical room. Then I found one, these are all real life incidences. I found one in Dearborn, Michigan on Maple Street at the energy company, had an electrical fire as well. And then I looked up, there was another one in Dearborn County on Maple Ridge Drive. There was another huge fire that had to do with a mother and daughter getting separated and injured. So I thought this just still seemed like with our Phoenix and our fire, and now we're given like, if you just put this address in the internet, Dearborn and Maple, you come up with all these instances of fires that happened at all these various places, states.
Cannot be a coincidence.
Cities, I don't think it
those
can
are
be.
Midwestern.
There you locations. Go. I think there's going to be fire, fire, fire.
Next scene, Chief Hopper rolls in as we find out to be late to his office, where he expects to engage in Monday morning coffee and contemplation, as he tells the office secretary.
She's trying to give him the rundown, you know, this guy needs this, this guy needs this, people are calling in. And I loved it that everyone else in the office was already there. And he's just like, hello, like he's making an entrance like Hello Dolly, right?
She tells him that Joyce, Will's mom, she's reported that Will has gone missing, and he tries to blow her off, which I think is super uncool of Hopper. I mean, someone has gone missing from his flock, and he's like, coffee and contemplation.
I just think that it's the type of thing that again, like back in the 80s and, you know, small town living, you're just like, come on now. He's probably just skipped school or playing a prank or hiding in the basement or just doing something silly. You know, like bad stuff doesn't happen here.
He doesn't ever give the secretary a chance to let him know that Joyce is waiting in his office for him.
Super awkward. So he has to walk right in on frazzled mom. The camera zooms in on paperwork and he's typing the word missing.
And still, he is trying to minimize the whole thing. She is very certain something very unusual has happened. He is missing. It is unexplained. And he needs to act now. And he is not trying to calm her down exactly. Because what he was saying wouldn't calm down anybody.
No, I think minimizing is the right word. It's just trying to say, trying to bring in the facts of saying, like, statistically, this is nothing. Where's your ex-husband, Lonnie? Where's he? Have you heard from him?
And because she won't let him pursue that at all.
I just think that she just doesn't think that that's it. Like, she, when she's talking about it, she just keeps talking about how he's been basically bullied for like a long time, that the kids make fun of him and that they make fun of his clothes and all this stuff, which again, I think is all this pointing fingers at like the difference between him and the other kids. I think that he is the type of kid, when they keep telling us that he's really sensitive and stuff, I kind of think that that's also one of those things where other words could be like intuitive or going to that part where like maybe he sees things or feels things or it just is more sensitive about things than others, which I think is a good quality to know about Will. Hopper, I think that his whole thing is just that he sees this mom who, when we're first introduced to her, she can't even find her car keys and now she can't find her kid. And I think he just has this kind of attitude of like, he's probably the last place that you left him. Like, you probably forgot to pick him up at school yesterday. You know, yeah. Like, he's really just kind of minimizing it. But then also, she is a frazzled mess. So could something legitimately accidental happen? Sure.
Next scene takes place back at the Hawkins Energy Lab, where some very governmental black suits get out of their black car. And they come in and suit up into hazmat suits with submachine guns, which is a pretty unusual pairing for a hazmat suit. They go down in the elevator to the basement where we saw the scientist trying to make his escape, and they find some very interesting things, including bullet marks, look like bullet marks along the wall.
Why do you think that they would bring like a machine gun and a hazmat suit and not like a bulletproof vest?
That would tell me that they weren't expecting to get shot at.
But not a human, right? Not that they're going towards something that is like definitely wouldn't have the capacity to have like weapons, right?
Right.
Because they don't do anything to protect themselves at all. They don't wear, you know, they're not in like riot gear. They don't have a shield. They don't have a helmet.
No, what they are scared of is whatever's in the air.
Right, right. So this is telling me a lot of information, right? This is much more biological. They aren't going to get necessarily killed by force necessarily, but like you said, something they breathe in or something he goos onto them or whatever.
While they're down there, the power is in much worse condition than it was the previous night, complete with a random light down the hall flickering, things like that. In addition to the bullet holes in the wall, they also find goo, an organic looking matter kind of stuck to the wall, appearing to pulsate and grow and kind of like a,
it's making a
sort of like
noise,
a tree
too.
Root sort of pattern.
Yeah. The only word that I could say, and I know we're at the energy building, but it had energy. It had some sort of life to it.
So when they finally do talk, they talk of two things, an it and a girl. She couldn't have gotten far, but also like, when did it get out or yeah.
Something like effect. When did it get out and she couldn't have gone far?
Two different things.
Yes, for sure. So we cut to kids' feet walking in the woods, which immediately I'm thinking this is Will.
Pan up and see that this is a girl, but she's a very androgynous looking little person at this point in her life. Her hair is shaved and she's wearing a hospital gown. Just has that sort of 10-year-old body, just straight up and down. And she sees, off in the distance, a diner. She sneaks in the back and finds some fries and starts pigging out on fries.
Pigging out.
She's face down in the fries. That's...
So she's totally eating anything she could see. And it looks like she gets the attention of the cook who spies her over there and is like, hey, what are you doing? And runs in there and grabs at her and real quick realizes, oh, wait a minute. Kind of sees like the hospital gown, the shaved head, the freaked out face this kid has and realizes like, okay, this is not a kid trying to come in pulling a prank or something.
No.
This person's in
trouble. He lays off the scare routine immediately.
Oh, yeah. Benny, I love Benny. He was such a sweetie.
Back at the boys' school, the boys are starting to really get worried and wonder where Will is. It is the science class that they all have together. Gets dismissed, and where it would normally be the four of them to meet with the teacher who is excited to show them his new ham radio, it's just the three of them. But they're still pretty excited to play with it and talk to the other side of the world.
I can't even, I mean, the whole idea of how amazing ham radio would be without ever knowing about the internet or cell phones or anything like that. What a crazy place to bring yourself back to and be like, God, remember when that was like something? Right. Just to be able to like hear a little voice somewhere and be like, maybe you're in another country. Wow.
They don't get to play with it long before the principal comes in and invites them all to his office to talk with the police. Hopper is there with,
I think it was Phil, right?
To question them about last night. What do they know about what happened to Will?
I was only about 50-50 on this scene with the kids because I felt like there was like too much ass grabbing around here.
Grab assing.
Too much grab assing going on. I just felt like when they saw the police and they are in the principal's office,
they would have toned down their Lord of the Rings references.
Reference it all you want, but the like bickering and the kind of squabbly and the, I think they would have been like wide-eyed and I think they would have been like scared. I mean, most people would say, what's like one of the scariest thoughts you could think of as a kid? Being called to the principal's office. Okay, what's another one? Having to talk to a police officer about something that bad might have happened. You know, like these are like top five things that would freak a kid out, you know, and make them like freeze
maybe
up.
Maybe it was nervous energy.
Perhaps. I just thought it was a little much. It was a little much. I felt like they were a little too silly acting.
And the chief Hopper was having none really of it. Not interested.
He was on my side. Me and Hopper were right in there together being like, y'all are acting fools. Like fools.
Before he left, he had to make sure to give them the, and I don't want you out there looking for your friend speech, which I would not expect them to obey at all. Scene cuts to the woods. There is a small fort out in the woods that Joyce approaches. And after supplying the correct passcode, she is allowed in where she finds Will. And
I was so relieved. I was like, yay. He was just in the woods. Like he got out. Like he must have run out the back thing of the shed. And there was like a secret passage and he hid in the woods and he's totally okay. And I was so like, yay.
And she's excited to provide tickets to Poltergeist, an R-rated horror movie from the 80s that if you've seen only the remake, then you should know that it in no way improves upon the movie that was made in the 80s.
We should watch that again because I haven't seen it in so long. And I know. I keep looking at the baby that's in the Mike's household and I'm like staring at her. And I'm like, child, I feel like you're going to come into play.
But we find out this scene is just a flashback. And Joyce,
was that heartbreaking? Did you feel like terrible when it like kind of came to and you were like realizing like, oh my God, the fort was empty?
Yes. But now we also know that this is a show that will use flashbacks.
Is this our first flashback?
Yeah.
This is our very first flashback. Okay. And so I kind of want to pay attention to the flashbacks and try to figure out if people are flashing back to anywhere near to the same time frame or anything. Because Will looked exactly the same to me as he did when he vanished. It had to have been within like a year or something. When did Poltergeist come out?
Poltergeist would have come out the year before in 1982.
Okay, so then they're flashing back to a year before because there were other flashbacks and I do kind of want to pay attention to them and see like, are they lining up? Are we all flashing back to the same time period? And like that actually is going to help a lot. I think they're going to give us other nuggets in those flashbacks that might help us pinpoint the time.
But it is just a flashback. Joyce and Jonathan are in the same point in space, but Will is not there. They're out in the woods yelling for Will. Go over to the diner where we find Benny is feeding the girl as much as she will eat, but she will not talk. He tries to entice some answers out of her because he needs to know as a grown-up with this strange girl what to do next.
I felt so bad for Benny because this is one of those situations where you and I have found stray dog before and returned it to the owner and the owner like promptly like slaps the dog for getting loose or whatever. And you're like, oh my God, did I just return you to someone who is evil? Like you escaped and I just returned you. And so I feel like Benny is like sizing up everything about her, the tattoo on her arm that is the number 11.
Which in the 80s, I mean, it would be pretty rare now, but not unheard of for a child to have a tattoo. But in the 80s,
I didn't know anybody.
A child with a tattoo
Yeah.
That would be like a unicorn sighting.
Right. And definitely the way it was done too. I mean, it was like
concentration camp style.
Yes. But of course, the hospital gown in itself and, you know, the shaved head, every part of it gave you the heebie-jeebs like, I don't know if I can return you to where you came from. You aren't lost. You're running from something.
So Benny takes the most neutral path he thinks he can find, which is calling social services out of the phone book.
That seems safe, right? Although a little bit, I wonder why he just doesn't call Hopper, because at least you wouldn't be calling a stranger, right? In theory, because, I mean, it's a small town.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, it's like the social services was like advertised in their little green sheet or something, which is a little funny, but okay, maybe. Maybe back in the 80s it was.
While he's on the phone, there's a noisy oscillating fan off in the corner of the diner. And as the girl, who kind of admitted that the 11 on her arm indicated her name, while she's eating, she stares at the noisy fan for a moment and it stops in its tracks.
So this is our first indicator that there's something up with her, right?
I think so.
I mean, there's something. Isn't that?
She hates noisy fans.
Right. Do you remember in Firestarter? Do you remember the first time you see her like?
She and her dad are on the run from agents who want to capture them. She has to set somebody on fire defensively, if I recall. So that they can get away.
Can you remember any other characters where we're introduced to their power or something like that? Even within comic book world or whatever, where it's kind of almost like casual like that.
Just kind of incrementally.
Because she could have just gotten up and turned off the fan.
Right. Like,
there was no danger. There was no reason for her to have to do that. So
the X-Men all start at the school. But whenever they need to find more X-Men, that's usually how they're, if they're young kids, that's how they're kind of found, is that they wish something would happen and then it does. I get the sense, though, with 11 that she has had some practice. I mean, she didn't just like knock the fan over, which would be sort of a crude, like, I hate that kind of thing. She stopped the mechanical thing from moving,
right?
Very specifically. This is sort of a focused, I know how to use this sort of power.
Okay. So they were showing that it was like a very fine.
Yeah, maybe Firestarter is a good
and almost like
idea there.
If you think about too, like maybe if you think about like human evolution and the idea of like using tools or something, and like how using like our thumbs and everything, and how that really makes us different from the previous evolutionary phase, the idea of her having a finely tuned tool of her mind.
Hopper has led just a couple of cops out on the road where they expect to find some clues, because that's the path between Mike's house and Will's house. And they get out of their car, head down the road, and then they do find the abandoned bicycle on the side of the road.
I feel like when they see that bike, it's the first, like, oh, man. Because I honestly still think that Hopper 100% believes, I know, I mean 100% believes, that he's just hiding in the woods, fooling around, skipped school, you know, went to the mall, something, you know.
But he himself has to admit this bike would be as precious as a Cadillac to an adult. So the idea of abandoning it doesn't work.
And especially as far out as Will lives and just being that age, like this is your mode of transportation. This is your everything.
We cut to the energy lab again, and there's a room full of people doing exactly what the government doesn't want you to think that the government does.
Oh, God.
Which is listening in on phone calls.
Oh, my God. There was like an entire room of people sitting there, and you could hear all this like, like listening, and they were just logging down, and they sort of got a live one.
Well, they catch Joyce calling Lonnie's house. Intercepting the call is Lonnie's current live-in girlfriend, who will not let Joyce through to talk to Lonnie.
Is that just the lamest and always used, oh, you're in a divorce, oh, I'm the new girlfriend, okay, now I'm going to start playing referee / blocker? Why do they always like that? Why can't they be like, hey, Joyce, here's the phone, Lonnie. You know, like,
yeah.
Why do they always got to get involved, huh?
In the background, Jonathan is making posters. Mm. And I think what's kind of, I don't know, going back to, I don't know if Jonathan's ready for adulthood yet is the way he's doing it. He's got guidelines for the top and the bottom of where he wants his block letters to be. And it's not that that's necessarily childish if you're listening to this and out there and like, that's how I write everything. But
it is childish. I mean, he made himself handwriting paper the same as what you would give a child who is first learning to write. He put the lines like you would have a handwriting paper so that he could make sure that they were all lined up. Now, most of us who are adults would not do that, and we would freehand it, and we would do our best, you know, and it would probably be like pretty good, pretty decently spaced. But you're right, there definitely are little things about him that seem a little bit more like either I can't figure out his age, or maybe like he's just a little bit, like you said, more immature. There's something about him that, you know, if he isn't working and he isn't in school, what is his deal exactly? We really don't know.
There's more to find out about Jonathan.
We don't know anything about him.
Outside, the police arrive and Hopper goes around back to his police truck and pulls out the bike, which for a moment, I'm sure if you were Joyce, this would be like, and I expect Will to hop out of the car at the same time.
Oh, no. And that's why you're dad and I'm mom. When they shoot a long shot of the police officer hanging his head, pulling the bike out of the back and slowly walking it towards you. This is the empty wagon. Here was the baseball glove he was holding. Like, this was here and everyone knows he never would have left it. And they shoot it beautifully. I mean, it captures every bit of like, oh my God. And Hopper's face is just like,
well, this is his admission that, okay, we have a situation here.
And he knows the news he's delivering. For the first time, he's actually saying, like, your son is missing. One thing that I thought was, like, a little bit, I'm not sure if I would have said this, but maybe in your sort of hysteria, you would say this. She asked if there was blood on it. The cops kind of all say, they would be like, what? No, what? They don't exactly say, like, no, there was none. But I feel like they were kind of a little like, what? Like, that was a little bit of a weird question. Hopper comes in and he starts doing that sort of police officer surveying the scene and he's glancing around. They are doing the very CSI, like watch what his hand touches and what his hand touches, the camera's going to kind of go over to. So he sees the hole in the wall behind the door and he asks her like, was this here? And she's kind of like, I don't know, whatever. I have two boys. I can't pay attention. Which again is kind of one of those things that shows that she's a very different mom than say Karen, who would be like, I would know if there was a scuff on my wall, you know, mm-hmm. I would know if there was a hole in the wall, you know, I would mm-hmm. know that. But there's sort of this different vibe about the household. They continue to kind of walk through and definitely Hopper is much more serious and he hears the dog barking. And that leads him to go outside to be like, why is the dog? And the way they shoot the dog where the dog's kind of looking back at the camera, it is very like a pointer does, like when you're like hunting or something, like this is the place.
Over
right?
here.
Yeah. So he's like, roo, 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 Rosalind, rear.
We're in the shred.
Right. It was a very like, this is it. Come out here. But in a weird role reversal there, Hopper's like, this is something. And Joyce is like, nah, whatever. The dog's probably just hungry. So they totally just like, this is something. We're onto something. And she's like, nothing's happening here.
He goes out to the shed despite her shrugging off. And he finds on the workbench the box of bullets that Will had been using the night before. And he does notice the empty rifle rack up on the wall. And he starts to notice some other weird things around the shed. The lights do go out. And so he pulls out his cop flashlight and finds some weird broken stuff on the ground. And he hears just a second of that same goo sounding, squishy sound that we heard associated with the stuff that was growing in the lab. But he doesn't really know what he's looking at, so he doesn't really know to focus on anything in particular.
Everything's just broken and I think just looks odd. And I think that he puts his hand on the hook where, like you were saying, that looks like where the rifle would have been stored and is sort of like, where's the rifle, you know? And yeah. Like he can see that the bullets are kind of scattered all over the place. And not to say that they would have been neat, but I'm not sure you just leave your ammo kind of like scattered all over the place. I guess if you leave a gun in the shed, no way would you find... Yeah, good call. You would never, ever, ever. It's just another indicator, right? An unlocked shed with ammunition and a gun hanging on the wall.
not okay. Like not, by at least not standards. Here.
I'm sure that's illegal. The light flashes back on.
Deputies kind of scare the crap out of him for a second, and he storms out of the shed and is like, we got to call everybody in, you know, put together. He doesn't say a posse, but basically a posse to scan the area and look for him.
I feel like the way that they use a lot of that technique, I know it's just very horror movie, but I feel like it's also very 80s where they get really intense. Like he's staring and staring and staring. And you almost do that thing like on the computer screen where you start looking and looking and looking harder. And then suddenly like the ghost jumps out at you and you're like, bah! They use that technique a whole bunch. They use like phone slamming down and loud noises and door slamming and stuff to sort of like cut your concentration on something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's just horror movie or if that's 80s.
Could be both. 80s horror movies definitely set a standard, you know, in scares that when they remake them things that are fresh in the horror genre these days don't borrow from those things at all because everything good was done in the 80s. So yeah, I think both.
We head back over to Mike's house.
Family dinner.
Again, everybody's around the table. Mom, dad, baby, kids, everybody's there, which again is not your typical these days. And Mike is being like wicked mouthy.
He'd like to join the search party, even though it's out in the dark at night.
I thought he was doing kind of a decent job of really questioning his parents and being kind of like, what in the world, you know?
This is in particular is the conversation that reminds me of the War Games dad. Because this conversation, the dad is just absentmindedly doing something I'm probably...
He pops chicken into his mouth. Like, while he's like, we really care. Like, he literally pops it into his mouth, like throws it into his mouth. That's a little too cavalier, dad. A little too cavalier.
You know, as a dad, I can think, well, I can care and
pop chicken in your mouth.
And pop chicken at the same time.
Exactly. And mom's like, I hope you're enjoying your chicken, Ted. Yeah, which, of course, his name has to be Ted. Like, I can't even think of the last time I've met a Ted.
Ted.
Hmm. Right?
80s dad equals Ted.
Then after that, he goes, what I do? Like that at her. I was like, oh my God, you're annoying, Ted. So annoying.
And Ted is just at this point thinking, well, I guess.
I'm in the doghouse. Like, oh my God.
There's more chicken for me.
Exactly. Meanwhile, throughout that conversation, peppered in is Nance trying to get a permission slip for
to leave the house.
Steve Knight.
She wants to go to Dearborn, I guess, but that's a no fly at this point. No leaving is authorized. She can't get any permission to do anything. In the woods, the search party is all spread out, heading down a hill. The science teacher heads over to Hopper, introduces himself, and wants him to know that he thinks Will is a good kid. This is when we find out that Hopper has a daughter, or as we find out in a few minutes, that he had a daughter. He tells the teacher he'll never need to worry about meeting the daughter because she's in the city with her mom, but someone comes up behind the teacher and says, no, actually, she died a couple years ago. So,
well, she just said she died. Because I have a feeling in our flashbacks, we may just go close to when she dies. Because all he says is she died. And we know through the conversation earlier that he's only worked in Hawkins for 4 years. And there's a comment later about him being the big city cop. And so it's like clearly he had this other life and he's only been back here 4 years. And so I don't know how long ago everything happened with the daughter.
Good call. Back at Mike's house, he's in the basement at the role-playing game table, and he pulls out a walkie-talkie that he uses to talk to Lucas.
Holy crap, was that walkie-talkie gigantic. It was like he's holding a CPU up to his ear. It was so huge.
This is the 80s equivalent to cell phones for kids. And
texting. It's texting.
They discuss Mike's thoughts on Will's usage of the fireball.
Mike says, remember when we were playing the game? And he put himself in danger to help the party. Like, why didn't he cast the protection spell? And so Lucas has this kind of moment where he's starting to think.
And then they agree that they need to just ditch their houses and go out and look for themselves.
As Mike's heading out down the driveway, he glances back and sees idiot Steve climbing up the side. Mike was like, like, y'all are disgusting and lame. And Steve's getting him like the, hey, little buddy, don't totally rat me out.
Back at Benny's diner, Eleven is enjoying as much ice cream as she can put away. And there's a knock at the door when Benny finds a woman saying that she is from social services waiting for him there.
Now, this is super suspect right away because...
government employees don't show up at night?
No, and we've had that kind of situation. We've had a situation with friends where they needed to call social services on a neighbor, and definitely they were told that no one comes out after dark. That was actually the wording. No one comes out after dark, which makes government employees sound a little like vampires or something, but they don't come out after dark.
Well, this lady is some kind of evil presence, because when Benny turns his back, she pops him one in the brain.
Oh my God, did that break your heart? Benny is one of those characters, for as few moments on screen as we had got to know him, I was already in love with Benny and wanted to know all about Benny and be on Team Benny. And then, oh my God, he was gone.
He was a soft target for that kind of thing because he had that rough exterior, then the heart of gold, and did the right thing and paid the price because he just didn't know enough.
And I have to admit, being a Gilmore Girls lover, any diner owner I'm just going to fall in love with. So instantly, I'm a Benny lover.
You think he had a little Luke in him?
Oh, come on now. You know he did.
Eleven is quicker on the uptake than Benny and bolts out the back door, where she finds two agents forcing their way in through the back door toward where she is. The scene flips to the woman agent's point of view from the front of the diner, and other guys, including the character played by Matthew Modine, come in the front door, and they start to rush out toward the back door, and that's where they find not Eleven, but they find the two agents on the ground with wounds in their heads.
And I'm pretty certain that they're forks or utensil stabs in their brains. There's a lot of wicked ways to die, but fork to the brain is a pretty wicked one. So Eleven is really proving to have some skills here.
Through this whole scene, the song White Rabbit is playing. Grace Slick's version is playing. And as the intensity of the scene picks up, so does the volume of the music. If you haven't heard the song, it's a great song. And it's pretty literally the adventure of Alice going down the rabbit hole and getting a lot more than she bargained for, and the big adventure.
And absolutely that sense of being in a place where you don't belong. You're the fish out of water kind of situation where everything looks bizarre. Everyone acts bizarre. Everything is turned upside down. And we've already got a lot of allusions to that as we go along.
You also hear it in a lot of TV and movies when reality has sort of been flipped on its head, whether it's because it has been or there's drug usage going on.
Yeah, right. That's a good example. So many times when they're trying to even depict a character on drugs, or basically that their perception has been warped in some way, they often do play this song.
So it does ring a bell for me in several ways.
I should know this off the top of my head, but what's the leftover song that they always play when it's that same feeling?
Where Is My Mind?
Yeah, same deal. It feels a lot like that sort of like, you know, only this one I feel like especially is more child-friendly because it's Alice in Wonderland.
Catch up with the boys out in the woods.
Dustin is so vibing on the chunk of the group from Goonies in this entire scene. Every bit of him with like the whining and the like, you guys, it's raining. And oh my gosh, he's just embodying every characteristic of
always,
Chunk.
Always that friend that's less physically able than the other ones. And Chunk was that in the Goonies, and Dustin appears to be that for these guys.
Absolutely.
They don't make too much headway. They just get deeper into the woods where the bike would have been found, and they decide to go deeper into the unlit woods.
I cannot imagine going into the dark, rainy woods as these little guys. Would you have been so brave at this age?
Dumb, maybe. I wouldn't know that it would have been bravery, exactly. Just uninformed stupidity.
Well, and like some sort of sense of adventure without realizing, like you said, the real life danger. Like if there's somebody out there who's really taking kids and you are just sort of like thinking, strength in numbers. There's three of us. Like, right. What could bad people do to three of us?
We have a Dustin.
Right, exactly. We have our bikes. Like, who could outdo us on our bikes?
The next scene had me doing exactly what I would have done as a small boy in the 80s, watching a show like this, when we flip back to Nancy's room, wondering, what does this have to do with anything?
So Nancy and Steve are fake studying with their flashcards, and Steve has got, man, he's got all types of moves, huh? This whole like, so if you get one wrong, then I have to take off a piece of clothing and blah, 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 all this business. Oh my goodness. He has got tricks up the wazoo, which for a high school, we're guessing what, junior or something, he's got moves.
Nancy is not completely having it. She does succumb for a momentary long smooch during another piece of music playing on the radio that intensifies in volume as they're going. It's Toto's Africa.
And so the lyrics seem like, what does this have to do with it? Although it is raining outside, so there's some rain going on. But I definitely zoned in on the idea that the artist Toto, the name Toto, is such a one
right
idea word. You know, no, you can't say Toto to anybody and have it mean anything other than Wizard of Oz. For me, I feel bad for Toto the band, because I don't know if they realize that no one's ever going to think of you in music.
Right,
they're only going to think of Wizard of Oz. I feel like Wizard of Oz is such a magical movie for kids. There is so many metaphors that have to do with what we're seeing right now. The whole idea of being a young girl who is trapped in a world that she has to have go on this quest and try to figure her way back home. The whole seeking out of, you know, staying away from the bad people and finding the good people and
not knowing which is which right away.
Right. And having your team of friends, right? You got to collect your team of friends and all this. At this point in time, I'm guessing that the girl that we saw in Benny's Diner is going to be the Dorothy, even though I don't know. Maybe Nancy's going to end up being the Dorothy. I don't know. I don't know how this is going to go down. But I definitely am starting to get this feeling. They're really pushing home with the music this idea of go to this fantasy side, go to this place where there's a character who is going to get lost in another world, and the other world is going to be so much more messed up and warped and bizarre than a normal kid's reality. So I'm really looking forward to that. I hope that's where we're going.
I believe that Mike is the Scarecrow, Lucas is the Tin Man, and Dustin is the Lion.
Whoa, that's almost like exact in the way that everybody looks and everything. That's crazy. Because definitely I would say Mike with those really strong cheekbones, that's like kind of what that character looks like to me. And of course, Dustin, how could he be anything but the Cowardly Lion?
Right, he's the easy one. Yeah. But the way Mike charges into this thing without really applying a lot of thinking exactly, he's more heart than brains.
And Lucas, I would say, it would be
the more, opposite.
The more practical, yeah. Right. He's much more like, you guys, let's talk to the moms, blah, blah, blah. So yeah. So I'm eager to see if this is how this is going to work out. You got the three boys and the girl, if that's how this is all going to go down.
But Nancy tosses Steve Harrington off.
Oh my.
Because her parents are in the house and she does have some sense of decorum.
Dude, that part where Steve talks with the teddy bear and is like, beep, beep,
beep, with his classic teenage boy.
Is it? Is that what it is? Or is it from like a movie or something? I don't know.
It's like chapter one.
Oh. I'm sorry. In the teenage boy handbook, right. They're like, find a favorite stuffed animal of hers and try to ingratiate yourself.
When in doubt, bring your own bear.
Right? Oh my God. Good to
know. Have a spare bear.
Oh my God. Spare bear. On a much sadder note, we head over to Joyce and Jonathan, who are sitting on their couches in the living room, looking through boxes of photographs, which I'm guessing Jonathan took, because Joyce doesn't seem to recognize many of the photographs. I think
she says like she hasn't seen them before or something to that effect.
Okay, so it seems like they're going through, and at first I wasn't exactly sure what they were looking for, but then I kind of got the idea. Okay, we're looking for a photograph of Will, maybe for the police themselves, or maybe for the missing poster. years, and we're sort of getting this moment between Joyce and Jonathan where you're realizing that Jonathan has led this life through his photographs here that Joyce has nothing to do with, and she's feeling really remorseful and apologetic towards him about, like, I'm really sorry that I wasn't here more and I didn't do more for you. And
she's weepy.
Yeah, and definitely obviously feeling horribly guilty about, you know, the fact that, you know, here's Jonathan feeling horrible that he wasn't home when Will was supposed to be coming home. But then also, like, where was she at the same time? And of course she was at work, and of course that's understandable. But, you know, in this moment, it's sort of like, oh my God, have we both sort of dropped the ball for this little boy?
Jonathan is supporting his mom, but he is not all that hopeful in this exercise, I don't think. Whereas Joyce tells him she feels that he is close. And I was wondering, you know, we know that this is the kind of show where there are special people. There's at least one special person, 11. She can do things. We've already seen her do some things with her mind. Is this just a mom's hopefulness that she doesn't want to lose a son? Or is there some possibility that Joyce is a special person and can feel that closeness through some other means?
I'm open to the idea that Joyce may be one of these special people who have some sort of ability to vibe off the universe in some way. I think a lot of times when you get a character who's a little offbeat, you know, she's not the standard suburban housewife mom or these types of things, then automatically I start going down the road of like, okay, maybe she sees life and feels life in a little bit different way.
I myself am strange and unusual, remember?
There you go. But at the same time, to your other point about like a mom who has lost somebody, I definitely feel like we've heard that on like news stories and things before where the parent will say, I feel that they're still alive. I'll know, you know, when they've passed. The idea that you have a connection to your child and that somehow your heart or your soul or your connection with your child would allow you to know something more than an average stranger or the police or something. I definitely believe that there's something to that as well. But I think you could be right that they could be hinting at the idea that, you know, maybe half the reason why she lives in the woods and, you know, she has had sort of, a little off-center life maybe is because she has seen things or done things or kind of gone to the beat of her own drummer in a way that other people haven't. And so maybe she does have a little bit of a different relationship with the whole world.
She does get some positive feedback in this way when the phone rings. I mean, it's not a positive experience, but what happens on the phone is there's a lot of static. There's some breathing, which she thinks is Will's breathing. And then there's some monster sounds. The phone kind of explodes in her hand and it goes dead.
And she is positive that this was Will trying to communicate with her. I think that experience would have been horrific. I think I probably honestly would have thought that it was our child in some form or fashion, even though I understand that it just was like crackling and all that kind of stuff, because it would have been apparently, you know, of course, so unusual to be getting a phone call, but sort of this prank call-y kind of feel, you know, around the time of your child's disappearance, you would absolutely think this is like a hostage situation. Like maybe someone's trying to get in touch with you for like ransom, or your child has managed to break away and they had a moment to like dial the number, but they couldn't say anything. Or
more like that, since there's no other communication.
Yeah, I would feel like this was our kid. I would.
It's very upsetting for her. And now the phone is fried. And so she can't do anything with it.
We head back to the boys who are out in the woods, and I love that they're using every little boy tactic that they have. So they think, you know, well, maybe if Will is hiding out here, we could entice him to come out if we tell him that he could have his comic books, and we all give him these other comic books if he comes out, and all this kind of stuff. I love that they got to the heart of the little guys and knew, like, you know what, if there's anything that he is going to escape a captor for, it's going to be if I tell him he could have these other comic books. So I thought that was like, way to go, writers. You got that. I could probably get Paul out of a lot of situations by being like, I have a comic book for you.
You might be surprised.
I would not be surprised.
They don't find Will, but they do find someone else. Someone not wearing any shoes, not wearing any pants, and with a shaved head.
Pantsless. Whoa, that made it sound wicked crazy. Definitely in a tattered hospital gown, which is always a red flag.
They don't see it that way, but they do find Eleven just freezing in the rain.
And the whole episode ends with like this big boom sound.
Oh, we like shows that end in booms. We were big Lost fans. We so do. Any show that ends in a boom, we're there. It. Yeah.
So what do you think so far? How do you feel about this first episode? Are you drawn in? Are you curious? How do you feel like the characters are going?
Oh, I am drawn in. I'd like to get to the end of this and see how it all turns out.
Like we said before,
we're going to podcast this episode by episode. So we're going to watch and then record.
We're not ahead. So we're not spoiled at all. So we honestly don't know what's going to happen. So anything that you hear us saying thus far, if we're hitting the nail on the head, yay for us, because we legit have no idea what's going to happen next.
And if we're saying stupid stuff that you know isn't true, though,
then please excuse us, because right. we're just posturing possible ideas.
But everything about it rings familiarly, you know, not exactly how life was in the 80s per se, but more like how life was represented in the TV and movies of the 80s. That part of it is very reminiscent, very real.
I agree. Paul and I would have been still pretty young in the 80s, so we wouldn't have actually been as old as these boys are at this stage of the game in 80s.
Right. We'd have been 6.
So we would have been pretty little. And so we can't really exactly speak to exactly how everything's going, but definitely 100% I'm feeling the Goonies and E.T. and all those great movies that we saw when we were little that showed family life, suburban life. It's kind of funny, but I feel like suburban life and family life isn't actually depicted that much in movies right now, right where we are in 2016. I don't feel like there's a whole lot. Bad Moms just came out. That one, I guess, made its attempt at showing it. And how funny and different when you look at that movie, Bad Moms, versus Karen and Joyce and what they're all doing and what's acceptable and everything. Some parts are like, wow, that's extremely freakishly similar. Like Joyce is extremely freakishly similar to the Mila Kunis character of trying to run around, trying to get it all done, spilling the coffee on herself kind of mom. And so it's kind of crazy. Like mom life hasn't changed that much since the 80s, it turns out. But then in a lot of ways, too, she's just the CVS clerk versus like an executive, you know, that type of thing. It's interesting how suburban life is sort of being portrayed in movies and TV now.
Especially pertaining to the kids. Like we mentioned before, this was the 80s. There was a lot less concern about letting kids just go do for whatever amount of time.
Yeah, you know what? When you say that, go do, that's interesting that you say that, because you're exactly right. In 2016, the shows that I can think of off the top of my head, you know, whether it be like Modern Family or
The Middle,
whatever. A lot of those things show kids having to be raced off to activities. The parents are always in the car dropping kids off to somewhere. In fact, a lot of times there might even be shots in the car with the TV point of view sort of like in the front seat, like talking and dealing with stuff, because everyone's trying to get to activities all the time. Like on The Middle, the one character is always trying out for things and stuff, which is funny because then we have this show where the kids are literally just going out to play. Nobody's like, you have to get home to go to Taekwondo, or you've got Kumon tonight, or like whatever. Like nobody's talking about any activities these kids need to get to. This is all just go and play. And everything we see now on TV, and I'm sure it's reflecting real life, is about, well, you have something from 4:45 to 5:15. You have to be here.
Well, and these kids are nerds. They're playing a role-playing game very seriously, and it's not being played for laughs. In The Middle, Brick would be the kind of kid that would play role-playing games if he had any, typically developing friends. But it would be played for the idea that it's funny because he's such a nerd.
In a real flip on that, the Goldbergs recently did an episode where the character was into D&D, and they did play it for laughs. They did play it for like that he was getting bullied by the jocks and stuff because they were into D&D, and they actually pulled D&D into gym class and made it to be where D&D was the thing. And they really did play it more for laughs. Like there wasn't really as much, like you said, like this was a legitimate pastime. There was no reason to laugh at it. It was just another game. And so it's interesting that I feel like the Goldbergs played it like a 2016 perspective on the 80s, not really as authentic.
Right.
In my opinion. Now, we weren't there, I don't know, and maybe this is just two walks of life. Maybe if you were 13 or 14 and you were playing D&D, maybe you were getting made fun of because you weren't, you know, looking at the girls and dating and whatever, whereas you could still be 10 or 11 and playing it and no one's going to make fun of you.
If we watch E.T. again, we might see, like, the older brother, his group of friends were playing D&D, as I mentioned, and
They were the cool kids.
Yeah, they were not the nerds. They were. Right. I think he comes home with, you know, athletic stuff at one point.
Yeah, and they're definitely older too. They're not like 10 years old. So you're right. So that, and I would say Spielberg, and so much closer to the time that this was happening, they got it more right, more authentically right. So I think Stranger Things is getting a thumbs up on playing it more authentic than, say, Goldberg's.
Well, with that, we will be back as soon as possible with episode 2 and beyond.
Thanks, you guys. Please tweet us at
Daily Review.
Email us
at our website, dailyreview.com.
Or hit us up on Facebook.
Daily Review. Thanks.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.